You know, I changed the way that I was training. I changed my approach to the pole vault. I changed, you know, I think up until that point, I was a good athlete. I was 26 years old at the time. I was a good athlete. I did exactly what my coaches told me to do. But after I no-hide it in the pole vault, I proceeded to take ownership of everything that I did. I listened to my coaches. I did what they told me to do. But now I was doing more things on the side. I was watching more video. I was understanding the events, not because they told me to, not because that was what was on the coaching that was on the schedule that week. It was now I have to be responsible for my successes or failures. And I think up until that point, you know, I was putting a lot of the responsibility on the coaches. It's like, dude, I'm a race car. You know, you change the oil, you tell me where to go and I'll do it. But after that, it was like, now I was the crew chief and the driver at the same time.
Most of us never learned how to train our brains, which is why most of us needlessly settle, struggle, and worse, suffer. My name is Chris Doris, and I want to make brain training mainstream. This is my series, Tough Talks, Conversations on Mental Toughness. I'm interviewing badasses from all walks of life on what mental toughness means to them and their unique approaches to strengthening their minds. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Tough Talks, Conversations on Mental Toughness. I am your host, Chris Doris. And before we get to our guest today, who is amazing, if you're not getting the daily dose mental toughness tips in 30 seconds or less delivered to your email inbox every morning at around 6 or 7 a.m. wherever you are on the planet, and if you're not getting also notifications of my blog posts that go out every Tuesday, and if you're not getting notifications of new episodes of this, the podcast that go out every other Thursday, then let's go ahead and resolve that issue real quick by going to ChristopherDoris.com. That's Doris, D-O-R-R-I-S.com /lists, L-I-S-T-S, ChristopherDoris.com/lists. And then right over on the right-hand side of the homepage. Oh, no, I had to delete that. It's just /lists. It'll be pretty brilliantly obvious. Name, email, click, and you get the goodies. So, raise your hand if you're interviewing the world's best athlete today. That's right. Yep. There he is. Right there. Dan O'Brien. Yep. 1996 Olympic gold in the decathlon. In the decathlon. That's 10 things. That's 10 events. 2 days. First day is 100 meter run. Then the long jump, shot put, high jump, and 400 meters. And then the second day is 110-meter hurdles, discus, pole vault, javelin, and then the 1,500 meters. That's ridiculous. His story is unbelievable. This guy is the epitome of mental toughness. I'm not going to spoil it, but I will say this in advance. This guy knows how to create from adversity. You know, I'll read you a little bit of his bio, but I don't want to spoil. So he's a 5-time U.S. champion at the decathlon, 3-time world champion at the decathlon, obviously 96 Olympic gold medalist in it, world record decathlons 1992 through 99, 92 through 2010, he held a world record in the indoor heptathlon, Hall of Fame inductee for the USA track and field, U.S. Olympic Committee Hall of Fame, halls of fame all over the place, and he's a broadcaster on CBS, NBC, ESPN, Yahoo Sports, and others. He was adopted at the age of 2, which I cannot wait to ask him about, because I was adopted too as an infant. That's just interesting. I didn't know that until I started doing some research. And he's adopted into a family with 7 other children of racially mixed backgrounds, which is remarkable. I totally want to. I hope he's cool with talking about that, because I suspect he would be. It's in his bio. So. I'm not going to read any more of it because I want him to tell the story otherwise I'd spoil it. So I met Dan many, many moons ago. I was introduced by a mutual friend, Lindsay Thompson. What's up, man? I hope you're watching this, brother. And thanks for the intro. And and now I get to reconnect with our boy Dan O'Brien for what I suspect is going to be one hell of a fun ride here in this episode, in this conversation. So let's go find him. He's waiting for us. Where are you at, Dan? Dude, it's been years. We play Lindsey Thompson. If you happen to watch this, and Michael Schur, I think it was Mike Schur.
That's right.
Yeah, that's back in the. I'm still connected with Mike Schur. Hey, I bet. Yo, Mike, what's up, man? He watches these. I don't know if Lindsey's going to see this, but if he does, appreciate the intro. So yeah, we teed it up 15 years ago.
Yeah, I was going to say I've been in the Valley now 20 years.
Man, might have been close to that.
Yeah, and when I first moved here, I could have played in a celebrity scramble of some kind each weekend. You know, so, yeah, who knows? It might have been the Alice Cooper. It might have been Steve Young. One of those golf tournaments.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, thanks, brother. I really appreciate you making time for my Tough Talks tribe. We have some fun stuff to talk about. I just read everybody your remarkable bio. And one of the things that I would love to talk about, because we share it in common, is the fact that you're adopted. And I was adopted as an infant. I didn't find out until I was 10. And that was weird. That was weird. I didn't find out until I was 10. There was a major identity crisis I experienced as a result that really turned my world upside down. But did you know that you're adopted into a family with seven other kids, right, of racially mixed backgrounds?
That's right.
Were they all adopted?
No. So six of the kids were. So my mom had two biological kids.
Okay.
Okay. And by the time she had those were from her first marriage.
Uh-huh.
And by the time she had got to her third marriage, where they started adopting kids, those kids were late teenagers, 16, 17 years old.
Okay.
Okay. So I was adopted at age two. I knew immediately that I was adopted. If I didn't, there was something wrong with my eyesight, because I certainly didn't look anything like my parents. my parents were really involved in a lot of church organizations, and they adopted my older sister, Karen. She was the first one. They adopted her when she was four. About a year later, they adopted me when I was two. And we were, a cool little family. And then they about every 18 months, 2 years, they ended up adopting another kid. And so there was four of us. But my mom's two oldest biological kids were gone and out of the house by the time I showed up. They were around, but they just weren't living in the same house. Yeah. And it wasn't until it wasn't until I was 11 or 12 that my parents then went and adopted two Korean girls that were just in, bad foster homes or bad adoption situations in another state. And, I love the fact that they opened their hearts and said, look, we could actually save a young girl from, who knows what's going to happen to her, throwing her back into the system or whatever. And so, so my sister, Karen, who's Native American, she was adopted first. And then I was adopted second. And then younger sister, who's biracial like myself, Patricia, she was adopted. She's, I think, three and a half years younger than I am. And then I've got a little brother named Tom, who is Hispanic. And so in the age range.
Man, that's a diverse household right there, man.
Oh, I'm telling you, in the age range of all eight kids, I'm just like smack dab in the middle from an age range. Yep.
Where did you live the first 2 years of your life?
So I was born in Portland, Oregon, and I lived in a orphanage called Waverly Children's. It was a hospital, Waverly Children's Hospital. And what was interesting about it is for years, you couldn't find any information out about, your adoption, your biological parents. But then as I got into my 30s, the laws changed in the state of Oregon. You were able to put in your information. If your biological parents wanted to find you, then they put in their information, and information like that could be shared. But what's interesting as well is I've had two really exhaustive attempts to find my biological parents without any success. So whoever gave me up for adoption just didn't want to be found. Sure. I was contacted. It was interesting. I was contacted by a guy in California probably 10 years ago who said, look, I might know who your biological parents are. And, honestly, growing up, and I struggled with my identity as well. And who was I and where did I fit in? And, tried to find kind of my people growing up. And,
yeah.
But I was really content with my parents. I didn't really feel a need to find out who my biological parents were, or my biological family. I think because my family was so large And by the time I got to be a professional athlete, you know, I'm a very giving person. I felt like I was helping a lot of people, you know, making a difference in other people's lives, you know, as a person, as a provider. And I just didn't want to open myself up to an even bigger family, honestly. It was almost kind of daunting to think, is like, if I met my biological parents and, you know, and found new brothers and sisters and things like that, it's like, I don't know that I could give them, you know, the emotional part of what that really means. I was really just, especially as a competing athlete, I wanted to wait till I was done. And even after I was done, you know, 50-50, I've heard horror stories about people who found the biological parents, and it, you know, it really affected them emotionally when they didn't want to have a relationship. So that's just kind of my adoption story. But I grew up with a great family, gigantic, big Sunday dinners, big Christmases, Easters, holidays. We went to Assembly of God Church, and, you know, everything we did was kind of around the church and the church community. And I mean, that's the thing that I probably miss the most as an adult is having this big Sunday dinner.
You must have a couple, three nieces and nephews.
Well, and not only that, you know, when you have a 16 or 17 year old, you know, brother or sister, they have kids, and you end up with kids almost the same age that are your nieces and nephews. And so I'm introducing a niece or a nephew that's only a year or two younger than I am.
Oh, that's neat. So when you're filling out some form, whatever it is, like for a passport, you know, and when you get to ethnicity, what do you put?
Well, I have to put in my best guess. You know, what I understand, the adoption agency or the Waverly Children's Home, they have records on my biological parents, and my mother was white. My father was of mixed race, African-American.
Oh, I read that. Okay. So you got that info. So you do have that.
So wait, I definitely, the Waverly
so if you wanted to, could you go find, do you know your biological parents' names?
I know my biological mother's name.
Oh, so if you wanted to, then you got info that you got.
Yes, absolutely.
Roger that. Okay. Okay. Fascinating.
And what's interesting as well is, you know, while a number of kids in the family really felt it was their kind of mission to find their biological parents, they certainly, you know, there were of the six kids that were adopted, half of them were able to find out some information on their biological family. Not always their parents, but it was a grandmother, I had a sister who found out about her mother. I had a little brother who found out, you know, who his people were, you know, who his family was. And honestly, it was, you know, and again, it's just, you know, one of those things, 50-50, you find out good stuff, and the other 50%, you really find out bad stuff.
Yeah. Right. Thanks for that. I'm one of the 50% that found out good stuff. So
good.
I'm blessed. Very blessed. So let's fast forward now a few years. And I would love to hear, I know you must have told this story a million times in the last, whatever it's been, 26 plus years.
And there you go.
Right?
I have to figure it out and count as well.
It's actually 30. The story I'm going to ask about, I think, started in maybe 91 or two. Anyway, it's Dan and Dave.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I remember all that, man. That was clever. That was cool marketing, the Reebok stuff, the hype.
Yeah.
Right. So it was all the hype for people who don't, you could just go Google it, just go on YouTube. There's all kinds of stuff about, you know, the commercials, clips and stuff that Reebok made about you and Dave Johnson going into the 92 Olympics, right?
That's right. Yes.
And who's the greatest athlete in the world? It was fun. It was all lighthearted. It was really clever. It was neat. I like the one with the commercial with the pumps. Like, don't tell Dave I got these new shoes.
Yeah.
You know, that was fun. It was good stuff. And then something happened that could be, well, you'll tell us if it was, in fact, a life pivot moment. The no hiding. Can you start where you're at, wherever you want, man?
Sure.
That is a story that is 100% about psychology.
Sure. So I do a lot of motivational and, you know, team building type of corporate speaking. And I talk about the significant moments in my life. And this is certainly one of them. You know, I learned more from a failure than I did from all my successes put together, which
That's huge.
And this failure has certainly kind of shaped, you know, shaped me as an athlete, shaped me as a human, shaped me as a man, and certainly as a, you know, somebody who was making the transition from a young adult to an adult. And, you know, but what, you know, I throw back to my family real quick. What's been really fun about my journey, you know, winning an Olympic gold medal and breaking world record and things. I got a chance to take this incredible family on this huge journey, you know, so, you know, when they raise the flag and the national anthem goes up at the Olympic Stadium, my whole entire family is there, you know,
and whether
you're biological or not,
it's nice.
You know, it was a great journey. So, I had a lot of success in the early 90s, and it was interesting because I, you know, always wanted to be a professional athlete growing up. And so I, you know, I'm a good athlete in college, and it wasn't until kind of my last couple of years of college that people started pointing at me going, man, that guy could be really good. My coaches started telling me, my teammates started telling me you know, and then I started qualifying for US championships and Olympic trials and things like that. And my talent was really taking me to another level, but I had a chance meeting in 1988, I'll never forget, at the US Olympic trials in Indianapolis. And I met Jackie Joyner Kersee and Bob Kersee. Wow. And Jackie Joyner Kersee may be possibly one of the, you know, she's maybe the greatest female athlete we've ever had here in the United States. And Jackie's an amazing athlete. She also played basketball in the WNBA. And
I didn't know that.
Oh, she won world championships and Olympic games and in several different events, but she still holds the world record today in the heptathlon. And I remember at that time in my life, I had qualified for the Olympic trials in the decathlon, and I didn't really have a chance of making the 1988 team. However, I got a chance to just go and participate. And it was just like, this is going to be great experience for me. Go there, just get my feet wet a little bit. And on the practice track prior to my competition, a couple of days earlier than I competed, I got to see Jackie Joyner Kersee, and I was just in awe of her stature. I mean, she was 6 feet tall and she was as ripped as I was. And it was like, oh my God, this is a really super, you know, incredible specimen as an athlete. And I got to spend time with her and her husband, Bob Kersee. And they said, well, you know, tell us about yourself and what are you doing? And I said, you know, I do the decathlon, but man, I'm a better hurdler. I'm a better hurdler and I'm a better long jumper. And if I could long jump farther, then I wouldn't do the decathlon. If I could hurdle faster, I wouldn't do the decathlon. And they stopped me in my tracks right there. And they said, oh my God, what are you talking about? You got all the tools to be great. I mean, you could be the next great American decathlete. You know, think back, when was the last time we had a great American decathlete? It's 1976, Bruce Jenner. And so it really got me thinking. So I went through the competition, kind of, you know, stumbled my way through the learning experience. But I remember being on the plane in 1988, going home from the Olympic trials. And I thought, you know what? They're right. I got to stop trying to get out of the decathlon. My ability took me to that level. I was all American in college, but my ability took me to that level. But it wasn't my, you know, everybody wants to be Carl Lewis, of course, and 100 meters long jump, you know, they're the glamour events. And I kept trying to think that's this type of athlete that I wanted to be, but I did have all the tools to be a good decathlete. I just hadn't accepted it. And on that plane ride home, I said, I'm going to stop trying to get out of the decathlon. I'm going to take it on 100%. And I'll never forget, it was 3 years later that I won my first world championship.
Oh my God.
I mean, I'd stumbled along through college and, you know, did a little bit of this, a little bit of that, but I wanted to make a living in the sport. I wasn't 100% sure what it was, you know, what that meant. But it wasn't until I talked to Jackie and Bob and came home and said, all right, you know, I'm taking off the kid gloves, and now it's time for me to really focus on this decathlon. And 3 years later, I was a world champion. And so in 1991, I've won my first world title, and that got the attention of Reebok. I had signed my first shoe deal with Reebok, and it was phenomenal because I was working part-time jobs and sometimes two jobs. I'd go pick up golf range balls in the morning at the golf course, and then I'd paint houses and, you know, clean up apartments in the afternoon. And, wow. You know, it was great because I had a great community. I went to the Elks Club and the Rotary Lodge and said, hey guys, you know, I'm an Olympic athlete. I'm trying to make it, but I don't have any money. If you can hire me. So I was painting people's fences on the weekends. And so I just, this community got around me, but I had a couple solid jobs. But when I got my shoe contract, then I was able to concentrate fully on training.
Nice. And
that's what enabled me to win a world championship.
That must've been a nice day, right?
It was a huge blessing. And then, you know, you get a good contract where you win a world championship. It's like, I got bonus money and, you know, it's you're actually an adult. You're paying all your bills. You're paying off your student loans and, you know, things like that.
All grown up.
But, yeah. So before me, though, Dave Johnson was the best decathlete in the United States. And so prior to 1992, Reebok had both Dave and I to this huge sales convention in Orlando, Florida. And it was the first time I'd been to Disney World, and they put you up at a nice hotel and they said, oh, we got a meeting, by the way, at, you know, in one of the hotel meeting rooms. And so I go in there and Dave's there and a couple people from Reebok. And then both Dave's agent and my agent show up as well. And Reebok said, well, we invited everybody here because we got an idea. We want to pitch you guys on this idea we have. Dan versus Dave. And what Reebok wanted to do is they wanted to take two unknown guys in an unknown event and get into what was at the time for them an unknown market, cross training and the running shoe market. Wow. Which was completely dominated at that time by Nike and Adidas and, you know, maybe some other Tiger, some shoes that people hadn't really heard of, because Reebok, you know, at that time had only really been known for their casual shoes. And then they sold nursing shoes. Remember those white nursing shoes?
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. So they wanted to break into the athletic market and just go big. And they said, this is unheard of. And so they said they were putting like 85% of their entire year's marketing budget that was going to be committed to Dan and Dave. And
wow. We were just
like, you know, it's like, well, what does that mean for us? And it's like, Well, you know, you guys would be in commercials and we'd make you guys into commercial household names. And they said, well, you guys interested? And it's like, of course we are. You know, Dave and I would jump at the opportunity to do that. But, you know, we even told them at the time, we haven't made the Olympic team yet. This was all going to be concluded. We're going to, the ad was going to be Dan versus Dave to be settled in Barcelona at the Olympics in 1992. And so, you know, we told them politely as possible. It's like, look, we still have to qualify. Well, God, you guys are number one and two in the United States. Nobody can touch you. We believe in you. You guys are going to get there. And so later that day, they had this huge, you know, we're in a ballroom and there's thousands of people in there because Reebok used to have stores all over the country. And so you had all these sales reps come in and they announced, this is what's coming in 1992. And at that year, it was Step Reebok. So it was a big step aerobics thing. And then it was Dan and Dave. And the place went crazy. And we went up on stage and we answered questions. And literally that was, I'm going to say September. In November, Dave and I of 1991, Dave and I went to Los Angeles. Dave lived in Los Angeles, but I went to Los Angeles. And for 2 weeks, we filmed commercials. And we filmed about 8 or 10 commercials. And those commercials debuted during the 1992 Super Bowl. And so we got a chance to, you know, just kind of, you know, be part of the process, building those commercials. And then on the Super Bowl Sunday, I had a big party at my house. I'm sure Dave had a big party at his house. And those Dan and Dave commercials debuted. And
how fun was that?
Oh, it was crazy. You know, it really changed my life from the standpoint of, you know, everybody in my town where I was living, Moscow, Idaho, and where I grew up, Klamath Falls, Oregon, they certainly knew who I was, but now everybody knew where I lived and everybody knew what car I drove. And every time, you know, they knew me in the Los Angeles airport and they knew me at the Spokane, you know, in Spokane. And they knew, I mean, everywhere you're going now, we're going to big trade shows and we're sitting courtside at the Laker games. And, you know, we, and I tell people, this is just kind of as a joke to young kids. I said, we were so famous, we went on the Arsenio Hall show. And the kids look at me like, who's Arsenio Hall? You know?
That's awesome. Arsenio. That's great.
Yep. So throughout the year, I would go back to Los Angeles for 3 or 4 days or a week and we would shoot some more commercials. But people just got to know us immediately. I was coming off a fantastic world championship year. I competed in indoor track and I you know, did very well in indoor track, but I had sustained some you know, overuse injuries and my shins and ankles and feet. And so my training wasn't going as well as I wanted it to coming into an Olympic year. But the process to make an Olympic team in the United States is, it doesn't matter what you're ranked. It doesn't matter what you did the year before. You have to go to the Olympic trials and you have to place in the top three. All right. And that's the way it is in the sport of track and field in the United States. And it doesn't matter what event, 100 meters, long jump, decathlon, heptathlon. And so my job was to go to the Olympic trials in July and qualify for the Barcelona Olympics, which were in mid to late August. You know, Dave, same thing. He and I both had to finish in the top three. And, you know, leading into those Olympic trials, I had missed some competition because of the injuries. There were moments as well during the spring that, you know, I was off shooting commercials. You know, Dave and I were doing appearances. We were at the Super Show, or, you know, and I'd think back and just go, golly, you know, and Dave and I would just think, you know, we should be at the track. It's Thursday afternoon. It's 2 o'clock. You know, I didn't think that it was really affecting my physical training, but I think it was affecting kind of my mental preparation leading into this Olympic trials. And so we finally get to the Olympic trials. And I'm pretty healthy. And as a decathlete, if you're 90% healthy, you're that's about as good as you can ask. You know, if you're 92 or 95%, it's like you've really accomplished something.
Yeah.
But I got to those Olympic trials, and I was actually dating a girl who was a high jumper from Arizona. She made the Olympic team. She was top three in the high jump, made the Olympic team. She was headed to Barcelona, and our competition starts. But what I remember most about that day is, Dave and I show up at it, and believe it or not, they had the Olympic trials in July in New Orleans. It's 100 degrees, 105 degrees with 98% humidity. I mean, it was just stifling.
Wow.
Yeah, but I got there early and got hydrated over days and leading in, and the competition started, and I had a really good first day. You know, my legs weren't bothering me that much. And I was in I had a huge lead at the end of day one. But day one's my better day. And then, you know, you have to score in every event is the key. All right. And whether you score a lot or whether you score a little, it all adds up. And, so on the 100 meters, the long jump, shot put, high jump, 400, I've got a first day lead. I go into the second day. I'm pretty exhausted though, because it's so hot. The heat just took everybody off their game. And so the second day rolls around. I open up the day with the 110 meter hurdles. Good event for me. Discus was pretty solid. I was on world record pace. Didn't throw discus quite as far as I wanted to. So I kind of dropped down below world record pace. But then we get to the eighth event, the pole vault. And the pole vault is a difficult event because it takes a long time. The high jump on the first day takes a long time.
Oh, that's why it's difficult?
Well, it's
that's difficult. The hard part? Yeah.
It's tough. It's tough. Technically,
yeah,
but it lasts 4 hours.
And
oh yeah, I mean, because you got 40 guys jumping on two different pits.
Oh man,
just, you know, the bar comes off, you got to put it back on. You know, it's just a long time in between jumps. And I remember warming up in the pole vault, and I just remember it's like a long time in between turns. You know, I would take a turn and I wouldn't take another jump for 10 minutes. And it just, you know, took a long time, and I wasn't feeling great in the warmups from a standpoint of, all right, I'm dialed in, I'm ready to go. Because in, you know, my past decathlons, it's always been, you know what, when they call my name, I step up, I get it done. And that really was the limited experience I had in the decathlon. I had only done a handful of, you know, decathlons up to that point, and certainly only a couple of big international meets. And so, you know, I waited for my opening bar. You select your opening height. I tell the officials, look, I'm coming in at 4 meters 80, which is 15.7 and a half. And they start the bar starts at 13.6, 13.10, and it goes up five or 10 centimeter increments, just kind of based on the competition you're in. And so by the time they got to my opening height, it had been 45 minutes or an hour since I took my last warm-up jump. And I'm on the side, you know, kind of doing my runs and staying warm and everything. But what happened is I went into the pole vault, and you know, I just really underestimated the heat. I underestimated the amount of time that, you know, I took my last warm-up jump and just really kind of found myself out of sync. And so my first attempt was really poor. My steps weren't on and my, you know, my pull plant was late. And then the second attempt was much better, but I came down on the bar. And so all of a sudden I find myself in a really uncomfortable situation. And that's a third attempt at my opening bar. If I don't make a bar, I get 0 points for the event. And it pretty much 0 points for the event would take me out of contention to place in the top three at the Olympic trials.
Pressure is on.
Well, and the thing is, I'm not really even sure what pressure is up until that point. You know, I felt pressure in high school. I felt a little bit of pressure in college. You know, nobody sits and explains to you, this is what it's going to feel like when you're on a third attempt here. And your sports life is swinging in the balance. And so, you know, I was nervous, I was scared. I didn't have any tools really on how to deal with it. I had been doing some, you know, relaxation and mental imagery and things like that, but not at a high level. And so, I got up there for my third attempt and I just kept telling myself, look, you're back in Pullman, Washington. It's Washington State. It's an afternoon. You're going to do it just like you do in practice. And, you know, I came down the runway and everything that could go bad did go bad.
Oh,
bad takeoff, bad plant with my hands, straight up, straight down. It didn't really even give me a chance to make a bar. So all I can remember is kind of hitting the pit and realizing I've not made a bar. That was my third attempt. I'm out. And then it comes crashing down on you. I'm not only out of the competition, I'm not on the Olympic team. Dan and Dave's falling flat on its face. Everything just kind of hit me at once. And I was in shock. I mean, just like in a daze, like, help me. Somebody please help me.
Holy
and God. I, you know, you're in front of thousands of people. You do the best you can to just kind of pick up your gear and move off to the side and
wow, you know, and
but you hear this collective gasp from the audience. It's like, oh, but that collective gasp means tragedy for me. But one of the athletes, I'm sure, was just like, oh, there's another spot on the Olympic team that's open here.
That I didn't expect. Right.
Yeah. So, you know, but my coaches and we decided on that opening bar. You know, I was getting a lot of instruction from my coaches and, you know, we just didn't get it done. And so, you know, I make my way back to the practice track and I got cameras on me and guys with, you know, the TV guys are all over me. And finally, wow. I get a chance to just get away and sit down for a minute, but still I'm in shock. It's just like, I mean, I'm so much in shock. It's like, what happened? I don't know. I honestly don't know. You know, at the time, it's not till months later, even years later, that you'd go back and just really analyze it and understand what happened. But I finally came to terms with it, went up into the press area or went up into the skybox area and my mom and dad were there. And, you know, I hugged my mom and had a good cry and then kind of got it all out. And my coaches came to me and said, hey, this is what we're going to do. This is the plan. And I think at that point I might've just said, hey, look, let's just, you know, we're done, but there were two events still to go and I could have just not done them, you know, and just took it's called a DNF and did not finish. But my coaches came to me and said, look, this is what we're going to do. We're going to throw the javelin. We're going to run 1500 meters. We're going to congratulate the guys that made the team. And we're going to answer every question anybody asked us. And without them, I wouldn't have done that. You know, I probably just would have picked up my gear and got in my car and went back to the hotel and hid out for a couple of days. And, you know, yeah. But, you know, my team, my coaches, I had two coaches at the time and they said, this is the plan. And I can remember kind of being in a daze and in shock, but I was out there, I threw the javelin. But one thing that I remember about it is when I was out there throwing the javelin, the weight of the world was off me. Mm-hmm. It was gone. You know, I remembered why I love the sport of track and field. I remember why I do it. You know, you get caught up in winning championships and, wearing the USA uniform that sometimes you forget. It's like, man, I really enjoy this job. I really like it. I love it, as a matter of fact. And so, I threw javelin. I think I got a personal best. And then I ran an easy 1500 meters. It wasn't pressure on me. I didn't have to run a certain time. I just ran my own race and crossed the finish line. And then, boom, the press descended on me. And, I congratulated Dave Johnson and the other guys and said, good luck in Barcelona. And then, all of a sudden it was just, I answered questions, I answered questions in front of, I went to a press conference and an hour long, just, it all kind of flies by. And, I tell people as a joke, it's like, well, luckily I was in New Orleans, I got to drown my sorrows.
I didn't have far to go. I didn't have far to go to get my first hurricane.
Yeah. And so I did that for a couple of days. And I remember, I think it was the day I was leaving town. I had to be on, there was a Today Show set, at the track, and they always are, Today Show always welcomes, you made an Olympic team, come talk to us at the Today Show. But it was like a 5 a.m. interview. And I was like, one eye open from being out all night. And,
oh, wow.
But I, but what was interesting as well is, I come home from the Olympic trials, and when I land in the airport in Moscow, Idaho, there's 500 people that came out to see me. And it was my team, it was my coaches and my attorney and saying, hey, look, we got to go support this guy, Wow, and
that's so great.
And so, yeah. And so it was one of those things that was just, I think it got get emotional thinking about it. It's just like, what would have happened if I didn't have that,
oof.
In explaining this to my father was, it just was, why can't they still put you on the team, and how come you did this and how come you did that? And what ends up happening is you feel worse for the people around you than you do for yourself.
Oh.
I mean, it was like somebody died in my family, it was, oh my gosh, you didn't make an Olympic team. And I had 100 voicemails, or, I had 100 messages on my, old style answering machine. And yeah. But I just, I got home and took a few days off and, did stuff around my community. And it was amazing to me of how many people just came up to me and said, we still love you, and it's like, cool. So, when people ask me about overcoming that, how do you do it? It's like, well, I certainly didn't do it alone, and somebody smarter than me had a game plan. And that was my coaches: get back out there, do your best, never quit. And I think without them, I might've just taken a DNF and, gotten back to my hotel. But I did get back to my hotel room finally. And NBC called me up and said, hey, we want to have you along in the broadcast in Barcelona. Would you want to come? And I was just like, yeah, you bet. So I took a trip to Barcelona for the Olympics, and that changed my life. Going to the Olympics, seeing the Olympics, I was truly inspired by some of the performances, but I also just got to experience the Olympics, and, had a credential, which got me everywhere, got to see my girlfriend high jump, but, I got to talk about this. I got to talk about the decathlon and analyze it and live in the moment of, when I'm out there, I'm seeing those guys compete, but when I'm out there, I can put myself in their place.
Yeah.
And at the Olympic Games as well, is, I met a track meet director who does a decathlon in Talence, France, called the Decastar meet. And it's one of the biggest decathlon invitationals. And he was just this French guy, Dan, you must come to Decastar, And I said, I won't only come to Decastar, but I'll come to Decastar and I'll break the world record. And he was like, oh, mon Dieu. And so they promoted the shit out of it. And I find myself 2 weeks after the Olympics end, I'm on a plane, I'm on my way to France. And what was interesting is, as soon as I said, I'll come to France and I'll break the world record, all that pressure and expectation and everything that I had on my shoulders that I said went away, it came back on.
Welcome back. Amen.
Yeah. And it was like, oh, and so I show up in France and it's cruddy weather, and, the track's not as impressive as I thought it would be. And it's just like, man, did I pointed to the left field fence, man. And I called the shot 3 weeks ago. It's like, now I got to come through. And you know what I did? I came through. It was one of those things where it's just like, I was just scared enough to, scared enough to push myself, and I just wanted it really badly. And, you know, and it might've been one of the most satisfying personal sports experiences that I ever had. And everybody's like, oh, it must've been awesome to win the gold medal and those world championships. And when I broke the world record though, in Toulon, France, I remember getting out of the shower afterwards and just looking in the mirror and just going, oh, I got it. And it didn't, you know, the pain of not making the Olympic team and winning gold there, but it was just a real personal accomplishment. Nobody else was around. And it was just like, golly. And that was one that, you know, I just needed in my soul, deep down in my soul. And it was a great way to finish the season. And it was a great way to start the next season. And it just, I think if I don't just, you know, if I don't go there, if I don't go to Toulon, France, and I'm just living with this failure at the Olympic trials, you know, who knows what my career would look like. But that is essentially the Dan and Dave version of it. Half the people that I meet remember me from Dan and Dave now, and half the people that I meet remember me from winning the gold medal in 96. And I think what happened because of that as well is, you know, I changed the way that I was training. I changed my approach to the pole vault. I changed, you know, I think up until that point, I was a good athlete. I was 26 years old at the time. I was a good athlete. I did exactly what my coaches told me to do. But after I no-hide it in the pole vault, I proceeded to take ownership of everything that I did. I listened to my coaches. I did what they told me to do. But now I was doing more things on the side. I was watching more video. I was understanding the events, not because they told me to, not because that was what was on the coaching that was on the schedule that week. It was now I have to be responsible for my successes or failures. And I think up until that point, you know, I was putting a lot of the responsibility on the coaches. It's like, dude, I'm a race car. You know, you change the oil, you tell me where to go and I'll do it. But after that, it was like, now I was the crew chief and the driver at the same time. And I had one of my coaches really appreciated that. He was just like, you know, it's time to grow up. All right. Now it's on you. You don't work for us. We work for you. And it really changed our whole dynamic, but I just became a better athlete. I was prepared for everything, bad weather, good weather, you know, track conditions, everything. And so when I, you know, going into New Orleans, I had an A plan and a B plan. You know, the next year, going into the following, the next year, I had an A plan, a B plan, a C plan, a D plan.
Yeah.
So I was, you know, I was ready for anything anybody was going to throw at me, and I was ready to go. You know, how far was I ready to, you know, I won two more world shot titles. I broke two indoor world records. I won a Goodwill Games between 92 and 1996 was maybe the biggest stretch of success a decathlete had ever had. So it just pushed me to a whole nother level. And so when people talk to me about, you know, it's just like, was it a positive or a negative? It was, you know, it was a failure at the time, but man, that failure pushed me higher than any other decathlete had gone before.
I wrote down when you said in the very beginning, I learned more from this failure, and I put failure in quotes.
Yeah.
Okay. Than I did from all of my successes put together. That's a huge comment. And you just told a story on that. It's, you know, that's like a sliding doors thing. You could have gone one way and we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Well, what's interesting as well is, you know, people talk to me like it was a choice. You know, even your comment there, in my life at that time, there wasn't a choice. To me, I was a young athlete. I was just really getting started, you know, so I don't make the 92 Olympic team. You know, that's the first time that I was ranked that high. I didn't ever think to myself, if I don't make this Olympic team, you know, I'm going to go, you know, back to school, or I'm going to go another way. You know, I didn't have a safety net. I didn't plan on anything else. I put everything into this. So my options were, you know, I didn't want to do anything else. I wanted to be a professional athlete. I wanted to be the best in the world. And I just think me personally, I wasn't going to stop until I got that.
That's spectacular. I like to slow moments down in these interviews for moments like this one. So what I'm hearing from you is that you said I didn't have a safety net. It wasn't a choice. That, I believe, is characteristic of someone who is infinitely committed to the mission. Choice? There's no choice. There, in reality, there sure as hell is. There always is, but not in your head. We're doing this. So you own, I used the word ownership earlier, which I love, which had my go home. You know, you took ownership. These are at the core of mental toughness. Ownership, take complete ownership, right, of what's going on in your world, and ownership of your training, and ownership of everything. And of course, then you go on and you kill it, right, in Atlanta in 96. You win gold. You are the greatest athlete in the world. What's it like to be referred to as the greatest athlete in the world? In the world.
It's always debatable. That's what's interesting about the title.
I'm sure you've had some fun ones.
But a friend of mine who's a Canadian decathlete, his name's Michael Smith. For years, he held the Canadian record. And, you know, he said it really plainly. He said, you know, defensive backs in the NFL or, you know, triathletes, you know, people might debate who the world's greatest athlete is. But in the decathlon, we run, we jump, we throw. And to do those three things better than anybody else in the world, can you call yourself the world's greatest athlete? And it's like, yeah, you can. So it's like, you know, I'm honored to hold the title because it was a title that Jim Thorpe created, you know? And I think about all the different people that held that title throughout history. And as, you know, Glenn Morris and Milt Campbell and Bill Toomey and Bob Mathias and Rafer Johnson and Bruce Jenner. And, you know, you got all these people. It's like, It was surreal, but it was also just such an honor to be able to hold that title. And I took it seriously. You know, I wanted to be good at a lot of different sports. I was a pretty decent golfer and I played tennis and, you know, it's just like, oh, I'm taking this pretty seriously. But, you know, my friends loved to pull me out of the sport of track and field and then just beat my butt in everything off the track.
Oh, you ping pong. Yeah. Greatest athlete in the world of ping pong. That's great. Can you tell us a little bit? I want to get to a couple other things, like your speaking topics, the psychological one. But before we do, in 96, can you tell us a little bit about like your mental prep? Like, what were the things that you did to make sure that you were in the perfect frame of mind going into competition?
So what was interesting is, you know, my mental game stepped up after 92 as well. We had to figure out, you know, how do we get over this failure in 92? All right. Questions going to be asked. People are going to talk about it. You know, and I think from a pole vault standpoint, you know, my coach and I, we took an opportunity to, you know, just become better pole vaulters. All right. And Coach Rick Sloan and I, he was a head track coach at Washington State for a lot of years. We said, you know what, we just got to become better pole vaulters. And we do that by studying the event. We do that by jumping more often. We do that by just, you know, you having a better understanding of the event. And so he and I did that from a physical standpoint. But I started working with a sports psychologist by the name of Dr. Jim Reardon out of Columbus, Ohio. And he was my sports psychologist. He was a team doctor for Team USA at these large track and field events. But I started working with him on the side. And we came up with a strategy where we were going to look at that jump over and over and over again and deal with that moment. And why did we do that? Well, first of all, we learned what we did bad about it, poorly, you know, what we did poorly from a technical standpoint, but also we wanted to numb ourselves to it. I wanted to numb myself to it so that when anybody ever asked a question, when anybody ever brought up the topic, it didn't affect me. And you think about a guy who's shooting free throws at the end of the game and he misses the game winner. And now all of a sudden they're in the championship and he's in that moment again, but he hasn't dealt with the failure from the last one. He's bound to make the mistake again. And so we were trying to figure out, how do we not ever make that happen? So we just, my coach and I, we used to watch it on video, watch the failure on video, boom, and then go out to the track and jump.
That's so good.
And so we had to deal with it from that standpoint. But then as well, from the mental side of it, you know, one of the things that I did is I did extensive goal setting programs, a goal setting program for the week, goal setting program for the month, goal setting program for the season, goal setting program, long-term goal setting program. And when I failed, you know, one of the things that kept me going was I had this goal, you know, win an Olympic gold medal, be called the world's greatest athlete. It was sustained me, you know, but wasn't sure how deep goal setting could go. But, you know, one of the things we did was to be a champion in your mind, you gotta believe it yourself first. And so, you know, I got the advice from somebody that said, look yourself in the mirror, call yourself the world's greatest athlete. And to do that, honestly, it's difficult at first. You know, I had to sit there, look myself in the mirror and say, you're the world's greatest athlete. You know, it doesn't make sense at first. And you can't even do it at first, you know?
Why do you think that is? You can't even do it at first. It's hard. Why? Why is that?
Because I think when you're by yourself, you can be super honest. Okay. And so many of us are programmed to believe, if I can't do it in practice, I haven't put the time in yet, I need more reps. And I think that as a young athlete, you're like, well, I haven't achieved that yet. I'm not to that status yet. And so that's the kind of thing that held me back. It's like, well, I haven't even won a world championship yet. I haven't even won a US title yet, you know? So how can I call myself an Olympic champion? But over time, I practiced it and I gave it an honest effort where I would look at myself in the mirror every single night. You're the world's greatest athlete, or you're the world champion, or you're the world record holder. And it took months to get it going. But once I did, it really made a big difference. Now I went to bed a world champion. I woke up an Olympic gold medalist. I lifted weights as the world's greatest athlete, even though I hadn't achieved that stuff.
Beautiful.
And that was what really changed it for me, because
that's huge.
I did that leading up to my first world title. And my coach would ask me about once a month, he's like, are you the world champion? And then he'd ask me in February and I'd go, eh. And then he'd ask me again in March. And by the time we got to June, I remember him asking me in July before an August world championship, are you the world champion? I looked at him straight and I said, yeah, I'm the world champion. I'm the world champion. And I went to Tokyo, Japan, and I decimated him. And so that was the kind of training that I really relied on, is this positive self image, this long-term goal setting. Yes.
Brother, you're hitting on what I consider to be the biggest mistake that I have witnessed people making, not just athletes, humans, in creating excellence in their lives. And it's waiting for proof before you occupy best in class status. You're nailing that right now. Create the state, don't wait. That's my mantra for that. That's so spectacular. Don't be it now. Be him. Be her now. Yeah. Bring that person into the competition.
Slowly
don't wait for medal. Don't wait for reward. Don't wait for the accolades. Don't wait for the trophy. Don't wait for the outcomes. That's beautiful, man. That right there for everybody. Gift. Huge gift for everyone. Sink that, please, everyone. Be the amazing you now. Like, stop waiting for any proof. Woo! That's good, man. That's nice. That is nice. Were you finished with that, or are you still going?
Oh, I was going to say, you know, you build the statue, and over time, you step into it, you know? And it's sometimes one foot at a time, and maybe your whole body's not inside yet, you know, but just you got to see yourself in there and up there. And I think I grew up as well with this, I was a dreamer, man. I dreamt I'd be on Monday Night Football, and I just watched those games. Someday I'm going to play for the Dallas Cowboys, you know, and that's just the kind of kid I was growing up. And I was really encouraged to do so. And I'm glad that I was able to do that, because when it came time to, you know, actually do it as an adult, I think that creative mentality, you know, gave me the rights to it. I certainly felt free to do it. But I will say, you know, there were trying to get there, you know, there were a lot of nights I ate macaroni and cheese, and you know, and when you talk about a choice, it's like, no, my choice was, I don't want to go back to poverty. I'm going this way. I'm forging ahead, not back. So no, you're absolutely right. But that was one of the biggest mental pieces of the game that I was able to overcome. And I think it was the one thing that set me apart from all my peers. Everybody wanted to win. Everybody wanted to be the world's greatest athlete. I'm not sure everybody in that room believed it as much as I did.
That's huge. Man, thanks for that. That's gold right there. So that's gold. You get nervous these days about anything in life? What do you get nervous about?
I get nervous every time I go on stage to speak.
Yeah.
I get nervous every time I have to speak up at a business meeting.
Yeah.
I heard it from my sports psychologist. He's like, look, if you don't get nervous, you're a piece of wood. All right. Yeah. Kids ask me all the time, you know, well, I say, what do you do about the nerves before the 400 meters, you know, or the 1500 meters, you know, what do you do about nervous tension and, you know, feeling sick to your stomach? I learned a harsh lesson. And my third world championship was 1995, Gothenburg, Sweden, leading up to the competition, about 7 days out, I'd start to kind of realize it's coming, because in the decathlon, you push yourself physically, you push yourself mentally, you're just on for 48 hours.
So.
And it's a real challenge. And I can remember leading into my competition, I wasn't sleeping well. And so I get a hold of my sports psychologist who's there as well. And the night before I compete, he's just like, come to my hotel. And we do 20 minutes of just, you know, relaxation and some mental stuff. And then the next day I woke up and I was flat. 100 meters average, long jump, crappy, shot put, even worse. Took me to the fourth event of the day to turn on. What I realized is that nauseous feeling, the nervous tension, I have to feel that. I have to feel all of that stuff. The worse I feel, the better I'm probably going to perform.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I
didn't expect that. That's funny.
And so it was just, that was one of those lessons. It's like, you never get used to getting ready for the 400 meters. I'd be sitting in high school and I remember having a football game on a Friday night. I couldn't think about classes. You know, I couldn't think about social studies. It's like, for some reason, I just, you know, I was always just prepping for a competition later in the day or the next day. And my wife said I was miserable to be around.
Oh, wow.
Know? Oh, yeah.
You know, there's a theme that I'm detecting here through our conversation, which I'm sure is a theme that has always been a theme throughout your life, which is creating from all circumstances. So you're talking about utilizing, that's a good word for it, utilizing events, utilizing reality to propel you, converting adversity into fuel, right? Like utilizing the failure.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right. For the Barcelona qualifying. And then nervousness you're talking about right now is like not resisting it, loving it, using it. Yeah, let's go. Fuel, baby.
And I questioned myself. There were times when I would be so uncomfortable before the final event of the decathlon. It's like, this is my job. Do I want this to be my job? But 5 minutes later, you'd cross the finish line and you would say to yourself, I was built for this. Okay. I just, you know, why did I worry so much? But that's just life. You know, you build it up and it's way worse than you think it's going to be. And all of a sudden, halfway through the 1500 meters, you're like, I can handle this pain and discomfort and uncomfortable, you know, and that was the thing. I got really good at being uncomfortable. And even as an adult now, it's like, I can handle, I can handle a lot more uncomfortableness than a lot of other people.
I got really good at being you're dropping some serious wisdom.
I appreciate
getting a new pen, man. My shit's running out over here. You had too many notes going. This is nice. So, all right. So you do all this, you do a lot of speaking. You mentioned that. And I was looking at your list of speaking topics and there's several, but there are three in particular. I would just spend a couple minutes on each, minutes, you know, because obviously we could unpack this for days. But so the three that pop for me are we just did. We just spent about an hour on number one, which is overcoming adversity. So check that box. The other two are, and maybe we talked, maybe you already did. You tell me. Think like a champion, and then expect success. Is there anything in think like a champion that we haven't discussed yet?
No, and we could just reiterate it as well. My think like a champion was understanding the long-term goal and waking up every day and performing as if you were already the champion.
Yeah, as if.
That to me is just having a champion mindset that I'm going to follow through, but also, you know, I buying into my coach's system, you know, being present each and every day. You know, one of the things my coaches said that I did really well was, you know, I could block out all the external, when I showed up to the track and I got out of my truck and I walked through the gate, I'd have collection agencies after me and I'd just broken up with my girlfriend. But when I walked through the gates at the track, I put all that behind me. Everything else just faded away and I was able just to run track, just do what I needed to do in the moment. And so that to me is thinking like a change.
Great skill, compartmentalizing.
Yeah. And decathletes do it really well.
Expect success. I love that. When I saw that, I thought, oh, good. Yes, please tell me about that.
So preparation, in my opinion, it's going to help you with that nervous tension. It's going to help you with that anxiety you feel. And I always used to think, you know, the more I can prepare, the less anxiety or anxious feeling or nervous tension I'll feel. And that applies in a lot of things, maybe not so much in sports, but it applies in, you know, think about preparing for a test. You know, if you're really prepared, you're going to walk in there and you're not going to be worried about it. You're not going to be nervous about it. But if you crammed all night and you turned in your assignments all in the last week, you know, you're going to be nervous about it. But, you know, expecting success to me was there's 8 guys in every one of my races. All right. 8 lanes in the hurdles, 8 lanes in the 100 meters, 8 lanes in the 400 meters. And I'd look down the line at the start of the 400 or look up the row at the guys. And I would think to myself, I did more work than everybody else here. I lived it. I thought about it on days that, you know, they were probably, I ran in the rain. I ran in the snow. And I would build myself up that nobody deserves to win this more than I do. Mm. I never thought in any competition that somebody else deserved it more than I did. And I had this huge deserve factor. It's just like, no, I was the one who dreamt about it, stared at their ceiling, went through every movement in the javelin in my head over and over at night. And so my deserve factor was off the chart. And so I expected success. And sometimes it's a little stressful. Sometimes it's not so fun. But I never went into a major competition where the gold medal wasn't the goal. You know, so often nowadays you see kids who just want to make the team, you know, make an Olympic team, make a world championship team. My first world championship team, I didn't expect to not only make the team, I expected to win the world championships. And I don't know where that comes from. And that's just my cocky, you know, that's just me being a little over cocky a little bit, but it really served me well because I set myself apart. You know, Michael Johnson and I talk about this. It's like, we didn't compete against the rest of the Americans. Our goal was to get to the top of the world. And so I constantly expected success, but in my work ethic as well was probably the best in the world.
I don't call that cocky. Cocky sounds like there's something inappropriate about it. I call that goddamn powerful.
Yeah.
Right? Like our conditioning would have us play small. To have us think that there's something remotely inappropriate about choosing to be the best in the world, even before you have evidence of it. So I don't call it cocky. I call it badass.
So there's a great quote. There was a great miler from Algeria in the 90s, Nordine Morsali. And they asked him, they said, how do you expect this race to go? And he said, when I run, my mind is filled with doubt. I'm never sure who will finish second and who will finish third.
That's awesome. That is brilliant. I love that. That's so great, man.
And I think for me to get a silver or a bronze medal, I would have had to adjust my thinking. Okay. And honestly, even as an announcer, you know, when I see somebody who has gold medal potential win the bronze, it's hard for me to say, oh, and she must be thrilled with the bronze medal. It's PC. You know, we can't say, well, you didn't win the gold. You know, she won a bronze medal at the Olympics or the World Championships, for crying out loud. That's a pretty great accomplishment. Yeah. But for me, if I were to take home a silver or bronze, that's when my thought process would have had to change a little bit. I would have had to figure out a way to be happy with a silver and bronze medal. That's just that because my coaches and I, we just knew. It's like, look, that's not why we came here. You know,
right.
we didn't go to that world championship.
We were going for a different piece of hardware.
Second and third. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
That's beautiful. Yeah, but speaking of announcers, do you know Adam Archuleta?
Of course, yeah.
Okay. Have you ever played golf with him?
No, I haven't. I'm trying to think.
Set that up. He's a good buddy.
Former client. I used to see Adam at the gym.
He's also been a guest here on Tough Talks. Oh, really?
Yeah. No, and I love, you know, I love his story and love to see what he's doing. I'll always watch a game when he's on it too. So, no, he's doing great. I love his humility. You know, he takes me back. He's like, he must be an Idaho guy. You know, he's just so nice.
Yeah, he's one of my favorites. So tell me about this Win with Integrity program.
Okay. So, so the Win with Integrity program was a program within USA Track and Field. And it was, we wanted to bring champions from the sport of track and field. So it traveled where USA Track and Field traveled. So we would have a big track meet in Texas. We'd have a big track meet at the Penn, you know, we go to the Penn relays, and athletes who were competing, and me back in the day, I was hosting it after a while, but we would take three or four athletes competing on the Saturday at the Penn relays. And on Wednesday or Thursday, we would take them into a big high school and we would do this Win with Integrity program, and athletes would talk about their success and how decision-making in their lives helped them get to where they are and where track and field actually took them. Well, track and field took me all over the world. Or track and field took me all the way to a college scholarship. Track and field, you know, but to make those decisions, I had to decide to be drug-free. I had to decide not to use performance-enhancing drugs. So that program was really big when I was kind of finishing my career and as I made the transition pass. Then it was cool. Then I got to go to those places and introduce those athletes and ask the questions and, you know, see younger athletes inspiring those kids.
Nice. So take us up to the present now. What are you up to these days, sir?
Well, I'll tell you, you know, it's all about goal setting and talk about accomplishing a goal, not only for myself, but for a group of people who've been at it for a while. So since I've lived in Arizona for the last 20 years, I've been part of an organization called Legacy Sports USA. And our goal was to build a large scale sports park in the Phoenix area. And for years we were at it, trying to raise the money, trying to find the property, trying to put the two together at the right time. And it wasn't until 2019 that the project got funded. Yeah. And we managed to, Legacy Sports USA managed to build a 320 acre sports park in East Mesa. We're just east of the Mesa Gateway Airport. And the sports park is enormous, 24 soccer fields, a dozen baseball fields. We've got 18 indoor basketball courts, 36 volleyball courts, 41 pickleball courts.
There are 22 futsal courts.
22 futsal courts. Yeah. Yeah. This place is enormous, but it's a destination for some of the largest tournaments in the country. We cater to the club sports industry. I oversee a 25,000 square foot performance center, which looks like a Division I weight room. We train all the club teams here on campus, but we also work with just individuals walking in off the street. If you want to get bigger, faster, stronger, come see us in the Performance Center. So it's called the sports park now got title sponsorship with Bell Bank. So it's called Bell Bank Park. And here in the Performance Center, it's called Legacy Performance inside the Coco Five Performance Center. And Coco Five is Devin Booker's hydration company. He sponsored a number of different areas around the park. So cool. Yeah, it's kind of cool to have that affiliation. Yeah. But you know, I'm doing what I love. I get a chance to train and influence young athletes. But also, you know, I just got back from the World Championships of Track and Field in Eugene, Oregon, where I was an announcer. So I, you know, still announce college track and field, professional track and field, and get to still coach and be around sports all day.
So funny. I wish you and I had talked just a week earlier than we did about setting this up. And you're a guy, by the way, you didn't need much time, much notice. You make things happen fast. You don't let grass grow under your feet. But the reason is because my birth mom, who I was reunited with, was there in Oregon, went out. Yeah, she and her husband went there. I would have introduced you. So, and you're also doing, obviously, we talked about it, you're doing public speaking. So if a company wants to hire that, you had me riveted, brother. I mean, you are good. I mean, not only is your story unbelievable, but your storytelling is phenomenal.
I throw some commercials in there too. I show you some Dan and Dave commercials. I show you.
Yeah, I bet.
I show you failure in New Orleans and, you know, talk through, but, you know, and so many, I think because of that happening in 1992, I became kind of a poster child for overcoming failure. And I remember I'd get calls from, you know, I'd be at a track meet and a mother would come up to me and say, oh my gosh, my daughter fell in the cross country championships. Would you talk to her? And I was just kind of this guy that, you know, was helping people, you know, kind of deal with sports, you know, sports failures. But I think because of that and learning more about, you know, failure and overcoming adversity, especially certainly through my life, I messed everything up in college, got kicked out, lost my scholarship. You know, that's another story.
Oh, but, I wish I knew that.
But because of that,
that'll be for round two.
I've kind of put myself in a position where, you know, I'm in a position to help other people overcome tragedies in their lives, you know, and a friend of mine, his mom passed away a few years ago. And I felt so fortunate that I was equipped to help the family through that tragedy. Mm-hmm. You know, I was kind of the voice of reason, and I helped, you know, I not only helped him, but some other members just, you know, think about it a little bit differently. And, you know, I think because when you go through that, you're in a position to provide some influence and some advice.
Good for you. So bellbankpark.com, and your site is your name, danobryan.com. If any companies want to hire you, they can go to your speaking page at danobryan.com. About 148 times today, I had the thought, I'm into mantras. I use all tons of mantras. Like, well, you just mentioned a couple of create the state, don't wait. But the other one that I kept thinking of throughout our talk today is a little bit longer, and it goes like this. Every set of circumstances can be created from if viewed masterfully. And you certainly are a master at viewing circumstances, particularly the ones that we would consider adverse, with some serious ass mastery. Dude, thank you. Seriously, thank you, because now I get to take credit for having brought you as the gift to my tribe.
I appreciate it. Thank you. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. And you know, it's funny, we don't see each other that often, but when we do, it's like, wait a minute. You know, I want to surround myself. And one of the biggest reasons I was successful is because I surrounded myself with people that shared the same vision and goals. But I was at a business conference just recently. It's like, you want to be successful, surround yourself with positive, successful people. And so, you know, I see you and it's just like, man, I got to spend more time around that guy.
How's that? Well, maybe we'll set up a round of golf with Archie, me, you and Mr. Archuleta.
Absolutely.
All right, brother. Really appreciate you, man. Thanks so much.
Hey, thank you.
Anybody got a brick wall that I can borrow real quick? Because I feel like running through one. Good as that. All right. How good is he? That was nice. He had me in rapture. He's a good story. He's got good stories and he knows how to tell them. Man, there's at least two massive takeaways. One is, you know, creating from all experience, right? Right. It's creating, not just creating something, but creating truly, like true excellence, like magnificence. From an epic fail. He said there's no choice. Well, we know that there is. But the state of mind that he was in, all in, I mean, there's no choice. There's one course of action here. And the other, which I think is maybe the biggest takeaway, is not waiting. I mean, what he's talking about, you know, I got this on my desk. You know, which is I'm speaking my way into being the greatest version of me every day. I speak my way into that every day. I'm creating myself with my language and I'm not waiting for evidence, right? And that's the same thing. It's like I got to get this quote down because I reference it a lot and I don't know it exactly, but it's from Muhammad Ali where he's like, I was saying to the world, I'm the greatest long before the world was recognizing me as the greatest. Right? Being it. Create the state, don't wait. Be that person. You know, if there's nothing else you take away from this episode, take that. We just stop waiting. Stop waiting to be the most amazing version of you. Stop waiting for evidence or support or encouragement or justification or rationalization. Delete all that crap and be that person now. And it's not cocky. Okay? No, that's smart. That's us. It's not cocky. That's us not playing small. Man, that's some gold right there. Speaking about gold, that's our gold medal. All right. Thanks, as always, thanks for tuning in to Tough Talks. And until next time, create miracles. Oh, by the way, forgot to mention, Dan's got a book out, which I didn't mention in the interview. Dan O'Brien's Ultimate Workout. Check it out. And check, if you're local to Arizona, check out Bell Bank Park. I'm going to go over and visit him. And definitely check out his website. His website's cool. And if you're in a position to hire someone as an inspirational speaker, I think you, do I need to say anything? DanO'Brien.com. All right. Until next time, great miracles.